Welcome to the Hutt City Baptist podcast. For more information, visit us at huttbaptist.org.nz.
Some of you are having that post-sugar coma right now and ready to pass out, right? But we do have a lot more jelly beans out back. Yeah. So someone asked me, why orange? Why are we sticking with this orange thing? There's nothing actually particularly important about the color orange, other than I'm hoping that once we are done with this series, every time you see the color orange, you're going to be reminded by what it means to be us. And what it means to worship our God. That's all. So we're going to see a lot of orange happening around here for the next few months. You're going to see orange in your jelly beans. You're going to see orange in t-shirts and a lot of different things. And I'm hoping just that you can come away, not just by, you know, purposely understanding what's going on, but also in your heart, connecting with what's going on and what it means to be the people of God. So, for those of you here last week, we talked a bit about God, who He is, what He is to us, what He means to us. And we began with the Garden of Eden, where He created this world, where He created this earth and this planet, and He created the universe, and He created us humans, and He created this garden, and He put us all in there until something happened. Until Adam and Eve decided to just do something that God had told them not to do. And it brought a kind of a break in the relationship between humanity and God. And because of that, they were cast out of the garden. They had to leave the garden. They couldn't be in the presence of God because of that brokenness, because of that sin. Now, God then tried to work out a way of saying, well, how can we get them back? How can we reconnect our relationship? How can we make this right? And so He gave us one thing. The first thing He gave us was, you know, this process of redemption. He began with the Ten Commandments, the basics. Now, what I find interesting about the Ten Commandments, if any of you had a choice of writing Ten Commandments for this earth and for humanity, would you actually write any of the ten that He wrote down? What would you write as the Ten Commandments? It's interesting because it actually says a lot about you. It says a lot about what you hold dear to. If you were to go home after this service and just write down, what are my Ten Commandments? What are the Ten Commandments if I was to get all of humanity to follow, to make them right in my eyes? What would I write? It says a lot about the character of a person. These Ten Commandments say a lot about the character of God and who He is. The first three commandments are specifically about Him. The fourth one, and the only one of the Ten Commandments, deal with our work, with our job. And He tells us to take a rest from it. And then the last five are about how we are to live with one another. But you know, He needed to explain a little bit more about the Ten Commandments because it wasn't just that. What He needed to do was expand on that. And how do you actually make this happen in our lives? And so He gave the Israelites, He gave them the law. The law, the law, the law. Please, the law. Like, we really don't want it, but I need the law. There we go. Part two, the law. But this was really convoluted, right? There's so many of these laws, so many of these things that, you know, it was great because it helped you to actually fulfill the Ten Commandments, but it was difficult to follow. There was no real sense of redemption in it or forgiveness. How do you, because we're going to mess this up, right? Kind of like my clicker this morning. It just doesn't want to do what it's told all the time. You know, and so God then brought in part three of His process of redemption, His dwelling place, where we can find forgiveness. Where we can find that forgiveness. But there is a price to be paid to to enter his dwelling place, right? So here's a question for you guys. What would you pay for great intelligence? If you had all the money in the world and you wanted to put a price tag on great intelligence, what would you pay for it? Numbers? $10? A little bit more than that? How much did you pay for your university degree? $50,000? Didn't get one. Smarter than... No, I'm not going to say that. Oh, a whole lot of us just went, what? So great intelligence. In the US, they did a survey on... they got a handful, a group of people within the top 1% of income earners in the US, and they asked them these questions, and they asked them, how much would you pay for great intelligence? The average price came out to $407,000. Yeah, this is for great intellect, right? Well, what about for true love? What would you pay for true love? It's priceless, right? Well, not for them. They had a price for it. They said $487,000. I want to know how they got 487 and not like a round figure, but hey, I tend to like round numbers, but how they got the 487? Well, how about this? For a place in heaven. That's got to be priceless, right? I mean, it's eternity in heaven. Well, they actually had a price on it. $640,000. Well, these guys have got a lot of money. They just don't think through it, right? Well, here's the one that you wouldn't believe, but for an extra year of life, they asked these same people, how much would you pay for an extra year of life? I mean, that it's a really interesting study where eternity costs less than an extra year of life. And the and part of this paper that was written, they said, it seems like the more you have tied to this earth, the more money you make, the more you want to stay here, and the more you'll pay for it. It's interesting, what value, what would you pay for certain things in your own life? What are the things that you hold dear to? What are the things that you want to hold on to? You end up paying quite a lot of money for them, right? To get into God's dwelling place, there was a price to be paid. There was a price to be paid. Now, the Israelites, when they came out of Egypt, you know, there were a whole bunch of them kind of wandering out in this wilderness. It wasn't really a desert. It wasn't so much sandy as it was rocky. If you want to talk with Richard or talk with Rach and Matt, they've been there. They've seen. It's kind of arid. Not the best of places, but you know, there they are for 40 years, and in the middle of it, God says, I want you to build my dwelling place. I want you to build it right in the middle of the camp. I want you to create a space for me right in the middle of everybody. And then he got really specific about it. He wanted it to be built and constructed the way he said he wanted it to be. He didn't kind of fluff around on it. He had exact measurements. He told Moses, he said, be sure that you make everything according to the pattern I've shown you here on the mountain. It's interesting, further on in Hebrews, Paul says this. He says, they serve in a system of worship that is only a copy, a shadow of the real one in heaven. For when Moses was getting ready to build a tabernacle, God gave him this warning, be sure that you make everything according to the pattern I've shown you here on the mountain. And Paul just kind of affirms, this is a copy, in a sense, of what's in heaven. Interesting, huh? This was God's dwelling place, designed specifically by him, and is somehow a copy or a shadow of what is actually in heaven. You know, if we go further along, we see that the tabernacle becomes the temple, and this temple gets a little bit more extravagant, a little bit more bigger, but still the same way of operating, the same way, the same design. And it's what we call the temple. This one here is Solomon's temple. Later on, we had Herod's temple. And later on, we'll find quite a lot of people fighting over that little small piece of ground in Jerusalem right now. where the US have gotten involved and all sorts of tensions over this little place where once upon a time this temple sat. We do a cutaway of Solomon's temple. We can see a little bit of what it looks like on the inside. Today, we're going to talk about the first thing you see as you enter into this tabernacle, as you enter into this temple. We're going to talk about this first altar. It's much bigger at the temple, but when it came to the tabernacle, it was smaller. And the moment you walked into the outer courts, the moment you walked in, the first thing you would see immediately would be this fire pit, this altar, where animals were being killed and then burnt. It would be in your face. You couldn't go beyond that point unless you passed this altar. So what does this altar mean? Why is it there? Why did God put that as the first point, the first stop? Well, there's two aspects to this that we need to know. First thing is sin. The brazen altar represents sin. Here we read in Isaiah. This is Isaiah. He has this vision right at the beginning of his ministry. He says, "It was in the year of King Uzziah died that I saw the Lord. He was sitting on a lofty throne, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Attending him were mighty seraphim, each having six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, and with two they covered their feet, and with two they flew, and they were calling out to each other, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of the heaven's armies. The whole earth is filled with his glory.' And their voices shook the temple to its foundation, and the entire building was filled with smoke." What's really interesting when it comes to this passage, a lot of people seem to be focused on these seraphim and thinking, "Oh, there it goes." But they forget the next part, which is far more important, which is the focus of what Isaiah is talking about. He says this, "Then I said, 'It's all over. I am doomed, for I am a sinful man. I am not worthy. I should not be here. I cannot be here before the Lord. I have filthy lips, and I live among a people with filthy lips. Yet I have seen the King, the Lord of heaven's armies.' Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a burning coal, and he had taken it from the altar with a pair of tongs, and he touched my lips with it and said, 'See, this coal has touched your lips. Your guilt is removed, and your sins are forgiven.'" As you entered into the tabernacle, into the temple, you would have been confronted with this altar. And this is how serious sin is. This is how serious God treats sin. You know, when you came to sacrifice, you had to sacrifice a lamb or a calf or a goat, something that was innocent, usually newly born. And you had to take it to the altar where the priest would kill it. But you know what? They didn't just kill it. You had to hold the animal while it was being killed. And you had to hold onto it until it took its last breath, until the last beat of its heart. You had to hold onto it until that point. Because this animal is dying for you. This is how serious God takes sin. I know we can kind of just joke about it, and we've got grace that covers us through Jesus Christ, but sometimes we take it just a little too for granted of what this sacrifice actually means. We kind of bicker and fight amongst one another. And we take for granted the price of sin. And this is a God we believe in who the first thing he wants to do is confront you on your sin. The first thing he wants to do is confront you on your brokenness. The first thing he wants to do is heal you and cleanse you and make you right. Of that animal is poured out that you hold to. As the life is taken away, your life is then cleansed. The animal is then lifted up, burnt offering, And guess where those coals come from that touch Isaiah's lips? Guess where that comes from? From the fire of that altar. As it touches his lips and cleanses him. That's the importance of how God takes sin. It's not something to be troubled with. It's not something to be taken for granted. Yes, yes, precious Lord Jesus has died for us once and for all, and we have his grace covering us. But do not minimize how much sin separates us from God. The next thing we see about the brazen altar, and you can't help but see it, is Jesus. You can't help it. It's foreshadowing something that is about to come. It shows us very clearly what's going to happen. Now, at that time, the Israelites didn't see that. But once it was fulfilled in Jesus, it just all clicked into place. Again in Hebrews chapter 9, so Christ has now become the high priest over all the good things that have come. He has entered the greater, more perfect tabernacle in heaven, which was not made by human hands and is not part of this created world. With his own blood, not the blood of goats or calves, he entered the most holy place once for all time, secured our redemption forever. Forever. It's interesting about this altar. God, writing down the specifics of what he wanted created, he wrote down, he told Moses exactly how he wanted this altar to be created. And so he creates it. He says, I want you to build this altar, and I want you to use acacia wood. I want you to construct a square altar 7.5 feet wide, 7.5 feet long, 1.5 feet wide. Now, I've got to ask you this. Has anyone heard of an altar that burnt offerings on it? Think about it. What's going to happen to the altar? It's going to burn, right? But in the process, it says, I want you to get beaten bronze and encase this altar in beaten bronze. Because he knows, God knows, it's going to burn if you don't actually cover it with something. Several decades ago, they discovered that with beaten bronze, they can actually encase doors for homes. And it becomes completely fireproof, the door. And that's exactly what this altar was made of. It was made of wood. The only instance in the Bible where you see an altar made of wood. And the only instance that we know of historically that any peoples ever designed an altar of wood. They were always designed of stone or of metal. And here we have an altar of wood, but there's one more altar in the Bible that we know of that was made of wood. What was that? It was the cross. The cross on which Jesus died on. The last sacrifice. It's interesting, if you go back to Genesis chapter 3, verse 21, you know, these guys, they mess up, they commit a sin, all of a sudden, they look at each other and they say, hey, we're naked. Ooh, that's a little uncomfortable. And so they go hide, right? They all go, they hide, and all of a sudden, you know, we can't look at each other because we're naked now. And they cover themselves up in what ways they can. And so God sees them and says, well, why are you hiding? Oh, we did this. Okay, you committed this. Okay, you know what? God then does this thing. He does this. He says, the Lord made garments of skin for Adam and his wife and clothed them. What is skin? Where did this animal come from? What did it have to do to give it skin? Had to die. So the first sacrifice made by God was to clothe Adam and Eve of their sin. And the last sacrifice made by God was on the cross with Jesus Christ. This was his plan for us. There's no price tag on that. There's no price that you can pay for this other than the life of Jesus. And when people ask me, why just Jesus? Can it only be Jesus? Yeah, this is why. Because he made that sacrifice once and for all. If not, you're going to have to make other sacrifices. What are you going to do? What are you going to pay to get into heaven? You don't need to pay anything. Christ has paid it for you. Jesus has given his life for you. Once and for all. And you are covered. The moment you believe in him, the moment you stop and say, he is my Lord, I'm covered by him. The challenge I have for you, those of you who've been Christians all your lives or even just recently, whatever, sin is not something to be put aside. You don't fool with it. You don't play with it. You don't make fun of it. Because God took it seriously. Seriously enough that when you offered that sacrifice, you should have been holding that animal in your hands. A friend of mine who says, you know, he's a vegetarian, and he says, I can't eat meat because I can't kill the cow. And he says, I understand people who can kill the cow to eat it, but most of us would have a hard time killing a cow just for the sake of killing a cow, let alone for the guilt of the wrongs I've done. There are very few of us that can do that. Don't minimize sin. For those of you who may not know Jesus, he loved you that much that he gave his life, even for those who may not believe in him, even for those who won't love him. He gave his life for you. I don't know if there's anything more I can say. Ask the worship team to come up. As we learn about who this God is that we believe in, who this God is that we follow, as we walk into his place, the place that he created, and we see that brazen altar, and we're reminded of our sin, we're reminded of what it cost to cleanse us, what it cost to purify us, what it cost for us to even enter into the space, into that holy of holies, that place where we can encounter God. We know the price that was paid. It was paid by Jesus. And it's no trivial matter that he gave his life for us. It's no trivial thing that his blood poured out for us. I pray that the Lord may not fill you with guilt, but fill you with a sense of awe, and a sense of gratitude, and a challenge to embrace a God that loved you deeply enough to sacrifice his own son for you.